Let's see if it's still recording.
Okay, I'm not sure what exactly your premise is. Is history true? Did it take place?
Is what true?
History.
You know, okay.
Is nature true? So what's your question? Isn't the answer obvious?
It's as far as we can tell, it's true.
No, not science. Nature.
It's not an illusion. It's all an illusion.
Is nature Torah?
There's only one thing that's true.
Nature is Torah.
No, it depends. It depends what definition of truth you use.
Right.
A truth as opposed to false, so there are many true things. It's true existence, that's something else. What? I really don't know where we're going.
Nature is not a manifestation of the Torah's truth.
Mystically, there's it's a manifestation of the letters with which the Torah was written. That's the mystical aspect of it. You want to say that all nature is mushrash in Torah, is rooted in Torah, you could say that. But you could say the same thing that history is mushrash in Torah, it's rooted in Torah, but it's certainly not all explained there. So, where are we going with this?
Had a conversation with okay.
It sounds like this conversation was kind of like a dead end conversation. Did this actually go anywhere meaningful when you were talking about it?
No. Please say enlightenment.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like the type of thing which.
Who would win in a fight, Yoshka or Buddha?
Probably Buddha.
He's bigger.
Besides that, he's less. Less than ever is Zora. Okay, so last time we talked history, we were talking about, it was 2 weeks ago, we're coming towards the end of the period of the Tanoim. Now, although we call the Tanoim anybody who came from the time of Anshe Knesset HaGadol, the time then of the Great Assembly, who flourished at the beginning of the Second Temple period, till Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the end of the period of the Tanoim, which is around the year 250, that's not 100% accurate. Because really the Tanoim are the sages beginning with Hillel and Shammai, who come after the Zugos, the sets mentioned in Pirkei Avos in the first chapter. Because those are the ones who actually were already involved in the composition of the Mishnah as it came down to us in its present form. Now, during the time, throughout Jewish history, it would seem that there were written records of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law, but these written records were not published in the sense that they were disseminated broadly. They were probably kept in a Beis Medrash or somebody had notes in their house, but there was no authoritative or definitive text which encompassed all of the basic law of Torah Shebaal Peh. That only came much later, at the time of the later Tanoim. The later Tanoim already started compiling things in writing before the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Sorry, I have a cold. Before the time of Yehuda HaNasi, for example, the Medrash HaLacha on the different parts of Torah, the Safra, the Sifri, they're from the generation before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, from Rabbi Yehuda's time and Rabbi Meir's time, and there's Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. They all were involved in compiling midrashim on the Torah, mostly halachic midrashim, but they were involved in compiling these midrashim. Even Rabbi Anosi, it's a big machlokes. Rabbi Anosi himself actually wrote down the Mishnah, or rather, gave it its formulation, but the actual writing down was later in history. In other words, it's according to some sources, Rabbi Anosi did not issue a written form of the Mishnah. Rather, he edited it, people still memorized it, and kept their own private notes. And then later on, in the time of Amoraim, when it was actually publicly published and just broadly disseminated. Okay, so the writing of Torah is really something which always went on. It didn't go on as a publicly accessible document. Now, generally speaking, there is a inclination in all areas of human knowledge, to try and retain the knowledge by the circle of people who actually understand what they're talking about, and not to expose it overly much to the masses who might, little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So therefore, it's likely, this is the way the Mishnah was treated before the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, that the Mishnah was treated as the province of the elite, the scholarly, the Sanhedrin, other great sages, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi saw this is not going to work. We have to actually broadly disseminate the Mishnah as much as we possibly can. This is very similar to what Rabbi Rakowski mentioned in Shabbos, as you heard him speak in Shabbos Shuvah Joshua, about the difference between the previous generations and our generation. Previous generation is very rare that somebody actually finished Shas. Now, every time Dick and Harry finishes Shas, right? Because there's an art scroll. So, in theory, knowledge should not be given such broad accessibility, because then people who have a little bit of knowledge can go and create the very negative ramifications. But that's the way Kleistro has seemed to respond over the years is that, no, we're willing to take that chance. We'd rather have people have lots of access and knowledge, because that's ultimately what's going to keep them from assimilating, from losing hope, from all sorts of other negative phenomena taking place. So ultimately, not just at the time of the Talmud, but of course since then in Jewish history, there's been an explosion of writing. Considered that, according to most poskim, although not everybody agrees, that one fulfills the mitzvah of writing Torah when one publishes a sefer or writes that or publishes an essay or something of that sort, akin to the mitzvah d'oraisa, the Torah mitzvah of writing sefer Torah. Some achronim argue that the most famous examples are of Nosson Adler. Nosson Adler was the Rebbe of the Chasam Sofer. He would not ever write down any Torah because he held the only patcha, the only leniency given to write Torah was because people would elsewise forget. And he had a fantastic memory, so he never forgot anything. So therefore, he would only write down like shorthand, very cryptic notes in order to remind himself of what he had learned, but he did not actually write any true svarim. So most poskim argue and say that's not the halacha. The halacha is that you should publish and disseminate as much Torah as possible. And this all goes back to the decision by the later Tanoim to, in fact, do this, make this, and to in fact, spread the Torah through the Mishnayos and so on and so forth. Now, it is important to note that this kind of stuff can only take place under conditions of affluence. You know, the art school was not published in Russia. It was published in America, right? Even though there are a lot of Russian Jews who demonstrated tremendous, tremendous dedication, nobody's publishing art schools in Russia, right? On the other hand, in America, there's lots and lots of English Torah, explosion of it. In the last century, I mean, 2 centuries ago, the 18th, 19th century, the most of the vernacular Torah was published in what?
Russia.
Germany, because the Germans were the most affluent. So, you know, they published lots and lots of Torah for the masses, which was like Chaim Paul Hirsch and other people, they published most of their works in German. So that German was the English of the day. In the time of the Mishnayos, and more true about the early Gemara, so they published in Aramaic, right, because that was the language of the day. So you can actually make the argument that, and of course, going back in the middle, in times of the Rambam published most of his works in? What?
Arabic,
right. So actually, when one looks at art scroll as a modern-day phenomenon, it's not true. Throughout the years, whenever Jews have had the wherewithal, they published works in the vernacular, and sometimes quite extensively. And it's interesting, there actually isn't that much Jewish literature in Yiddish. Because usually Yiddish was spoken in the areas where Jews were oppressed. They couldn't afford to publish that much. They were kind of poor. So every money they had for publishing went to publish the few Sfarim which got published. It's very rare, actually, that Sfarim were published in Yiddish. But Arabic and German and English, all these languages, lots and lots of stuff. Okay? So going back to, of course, have you... What?
It's a bit depressing because I feel like I'm just like, you know, one of these populist Jews. you know, for the masses, like an ignorant, which I am, obviously. But I mean, it's just as like.
Would I rather be an elitist?
No, but I mean.
So it's what's like, the problem?
Because it seems like in any other movement, where you have, you know, like the scholars and then the masses always have a more of a negative sort of ignorant connotation, which is true, I think. Of the people, but it's like always like they're missing out on something big that only the masters know. Just like the rabbis, the learned rabbis.
But I don't think it's true anymore.
You don't think that's true?
I don't think it was true in 19th century Germany either. I think the rabbis, although so it was true, more true than it is today, certainly then the rabbis did know significantly more in congregants, but the gap was much less than in Eastern Europe. And here in America, the gap is almost non-existent between the rabbis and the lay people. The rabbis are dumber, the lay people are smarter, so, you know, the gap is very, very narrow. Right? I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
It's bad that
the rabbis are dumb, but it's good that the masses are smart, right? And if we have dumb rabbis, we've got to have smart masses, otherwise the whole structure falls apart, right?
We got to get the laymen to become rabbis. So right? We got to get the laymen to become rabbis.
Well, then.
So the masses are relatively smart.
No, absolutely smarter. Absolutely smarter. Like Rabbi Rakowski said on Shabbos, in the 40s and 50s, there were very few learned lay people in Judaism. Right? It's very, very, I'm talking about among the Orthodox. Very few. The average layperson today is yeshiva educated. The average layperson back in the 40s and 50s was public school educated. The average layperson who even went to yeshiva till through the 70s went to a very watered down yeshiva day school, and now the day schools are much more intensive. Now there is a shortcoming, a deficit in this because the secular studies have suffered tremendously, as you know from personal experience.
I do.
Yeah. But the advantage in the study of Torah has been immense. So I think this is part of what Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was trying to accomplish, that Torah should be more accessible. So he was kind of a bridging between the inaccessible period and the more accessible period. He himself, again, might not have written down the Mishnah, but he gave sanction for it. He said, this is what we should do, this is what we're going further, what's going to happen. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was also you have to do this in addition to the affluence. He was extremely rich. That always helps. Whenever you're rich, you can afford to do lots of stuff that you can't do otherwise. So Rabbi Yehuda was able to actually spend the time and the money on having this work done. He also was on very good terms with the Romans. In fact, there was one Roman, we're not sure if it was a governor, an emperor, exactly who it was, but a friend of his was one of the Roman either generals or governors or perhaps even an emperor himself, and Antoninus was his name, Anthony, and they got along very, very well. They used to eat in each other's houses. They used to have a lot of theological conversations, and this is very good for the Jews. Obviously, there's a famous story that Antoninus came to Rebbe's house Shabbos morning, and they served him cold food, and it was the best food he ever tasted, and he asked Rabbi Yonasi, what's your secret spice? And he said, we have a special spice which is called Shabbos, right? So that spice of Shabbos, it's interesting, even a goy consensus, right? It's true, Antonius was a holy kind of goy, but he said was able to sense that Kedusha in the food.
How would he go to him and eat at his place?
Sorry?
How would he go to his place?
The same way people go to the White House and eat. They bring in a lot of kosher food.
They bring their own food.
Yeah. Wait, they just invented airline meals.
No, travel to Rome.
What?
To travel to Rome.
In Rome, they also probably had a kosher kitchen. If you travel to Europe, you can get kosher meals. As a matter of fact, they're better kosher meals
back in the
Europe.
Day, because they were all pagan.
What?
Back in the day.
But there was a substantial Jewish colony in Rome.
Already.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of very influential and large colony of Jews already lived in Rome back then, for sure.
This is well over
100 years past the destruction of the
temple. Did you have colonies elsewhere?
You did, and especially in Babel, where it could be the majority of the Jews even remained. But certainly after the second after the dispersion, at the end of the second Talmud period, so you had colonies all over the world. You know, have business, Jew will travel. And they went all over the world to seek out opportunities.
Why wouldn't they all be come back to Israel for the
for what?
Second temple?
Sorry?
Why didn't all the colonies put Lorets come back to
Why is everybody going back to Israel now?
Well, because there's no temple.
So what? If there was a temple, you would go?
It was comfortable.
I think so, yeah.
I don't believe it. Don't believe it.
If there was a Mashiach in the temple, we wouldn't all go.
What?
If there was a Mashiach in the temple, wouldn't we have to?
Why? You said that's one of the conditions for redemption?
Yes, but I think he's only ingathered the exiles who want to go.
Oh.
But the Jews always had, Jews, they're tough people, the Jews. It's difficult to please them, you know, so they get comfortable in Chutz La'aretz. Who says they won't stay in Chutz La'aretz? It's not so posh to me that Mashiach is going to be able to get all these Jews out of America. You know, the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, which is a very convenient Shita, Rabbi Yehuda to the town and not Rabbi Yehuda and Nasi.
Just political.
I'm sorry?
Just political.
He held that Eretz Yisrael will eventually be any land which falls within the latitudes of the Lebanon to Egypt, all around the globe. Who are getting? So, you know, now, the problem is in America, it hits kind of around Atlanta. So, you know, the Jews are probably all going to have to move down south. But,
Atlanta's
nice.
Atlanta's nice.
Savannah, right? So
they, But it also crosses through California, then.
What? Also crosses through California, yeah. So the,
That's good.
LA area.
Arizona.
So, Rabbi Huda's...
Is it Oklahoma City?
You gotta look at it. I can't help you on this one. So the, So the Rabbi Yehuda Shita is very convenient for those Jews who want to remain in Chutz La'aretz. But certainly during the time of Beit HaMikdash, there were many, many Jews all over the world.
I'm pretty sure if like a temple fell from the heavens to the earth, more than Jews want to go to visit it.
As tourists, yes.
Three times a year.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
No. He was saying they want to move there.
I moved if the temple fell down.
You might move at first, but who says you wouldn't be back afterwards? Let's not get, if you have to say where Shia comes, everybody will move back to Israel, but it doesn't say explicitly anywhere that that's the case.
What about the world will become like Israel and Israel will be like Yerushalayim?
Well, we don't know if it means the whole world. That's to say maybe Rabbi Huda's Shia, you know, that area around, that belt around the world. I don't think it means the entire globe. He says, "I see the Eretz Yisrael should be spashed b'chol rotos. Eretz Yisrael will extend to all lands, but doesn't mean all over those lands. You know, just in certain areas." Anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's major accomplishment was the redacting of the Mishnah, but also Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was a very, very important political leader, and he also was a very important spiritual leader, and he was of course the head of the Sanhedrin during his time. And he was the last person to serve simultaneously as the head of the Sanhedrin and the Nasi, meaning the political leader and the spiritual leader, after his death that no longer continued. And also he was a person who was a very big Baal Midos. He was a very kind person. There's a famous story in Gemara Ksuvos about Rebbe and the cow. Who knows, we call Rabbi Anasi Rebbe, or because he's the Rav of Klai Yisrael, the Rebbe of Klai Yisrael, like Moshe Rabbeinu, so Rabbi Anasi is sometimes called Rabbeinu HaKadosh, or Rebbe. So Rebbe was, who knows the story about the cow and Rebbe? Calf, actually. So some of you know the story, you just don't remember that you know the story. There was a calf being led to slaughter, and it ran to Rabbi Anasi, and Rabbi Anasi to actually be saved, because we didn't want to be slaughtered. So Rabbi Nasi said to the calf, "Go, because for this you were created." And they got very upset at him in heaven. So they gave him a terrible, terrible stomach disease, from which he suffered for 13 years. And it says that he would specifically go to attend to his needs when the grind mill in town was grinding, and still the shouts of pain of his agony would be louder than the grinding of the grind mill. So he was in big pain. 13 years. The Gemara also says that. So he had terrible toothaches, and finally They have 30 years, according to one version in the Gemara. So there, his maid was sweeping out a bunch of moles or some other type of mouse-like creature from the house, and she was doing, I guess, a particularly mean way. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says to her, "Listen, be gentle to them." It says, "Rachma v'akoma," so God has mercy on all his creatures, and that's when his pains went away. According to a different version, although it's not a contradiction, Rabbi Chia, who was one of his prime students, had a bit of a falling out with him, and the way in heaven they engineered the two got back together again was that Hashem sent Eliyahu Navi as if he was Rabbi Chia, and Rabbi Yonos was suffering from tremendous toothache. Rabbi Chia, i.e. Eliyahu, came in, healed the toothache, and then Rabbi was very happy, and he gave Rabbi Chia, he and Rabbi Chia started getting along again. So, but he was obviously very concerned with people, and the lesson was from this episode that he learned all this concern. And the Gemara in Tzuvos gives a tremendously long description of how much agony people underwent when Rebbe died. How it was very traumatic for people, because he was a really beloved and the last great leader which the Jews had. Okay, so he finished the Mishnah in around the year 250. Whether he wrote it down or just edited it. The Mishnah is a very, very, very concise record of all the major principles of Torah Shabbat there. It says that Rebbe worked with, according to one version, 400 mesechtos, or 600 mesechtos, and he distilled them into 60. So obviously, it's a very, as anybody who's learned the Mishnah knows, it's a very compact and condensed form of Torah Shabbat there. Is elaborated in the brisos. The brisos literally means external material, right? Brisos means outside. And the brisos are, you know, what ended up on the cutting floor to a large extent. In other words, the parts which didn't make it into the Mishnah are in the brisos. There is the main compilation of brisos is called the Tosefta. And that appears in the back of the Gemara. But there was by no means only one compilation of brises. That is the most authoritative one. There are many other ones. In many Bate Medrash, they had their own version of the brises. And in many cases, Gemara quotes brises, which we have no knowledge of their source, particularly Yerushalmi. But we actually assume that they came from one of these alternate versions of the brises which existed.
But they're not less authoritative.
Sorry? They're less authoritative, right. So the primary one, Tosefta, was edited by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's students, Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yoshua. Now, what about Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's students? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's greatest student was Rav. His second greatest student was Rabbi Yochanan. Even though we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan over Rav, because Rabbi Yochanan was sharper, but Rav was considered to be the...
Stricter?
Not stricter, but more of the leader than Rabbi Yochanan, to a certain extent. So in any case, there was a transition time between the period of the Tanoim, which ended with Rabbi Hanasi, and the beginning of the Amoraim, in which you had people who were all sorts of intermediate figures. They were on the one hand, they were like Tanoim, on the other hand, they were like Amoraim. For example,
Rav was the only one who was like
that. Oh, no. For example, he's the only one who didn't have smicha, who was like that. Okay, but you have Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Yoshia, who don't appear in the Mishnayos, who do appear in the Brises, they have the status of Tanoim. And also, before that, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's immediate successor was a very obscure rabbi by the name of Rabbi Efes, which means Rabbi Zero, he was immediate successor as Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, a bunch of other rabbanim who were transition figures. And that which says Rav Tanapoli, Rav was from the younger Talmidim of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was the greatest, the chief among the younger Talmidim. And he was certainly the greatest one who did not get smicha from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So therefore, it's a chiddush to say that Tanapoli extends even to Rav. That he can argue in Mishnah. But certainly earlier Tanoim, who were students of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in the early years, were allowed to argue on Tanoim as well. Okay, and other Tanoim. So, this, by the way, Rav was the first great scholar who was deliberately barred from getting true smicha. Now, of course, many great scholars in the time of the Mishnah didn't get smicha for one reason or another. They died young. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, these are great sages who died young and therefore were not zoche to get smicha. The other people who they would try to give smicha to, but for whatever reason, they were not able to give, sometimes because, you know, there are a lot of decrees by the Romans against giving smicha, things like that. But when Rav went down to Babel, Rav decided he's going to, Rav was, since he was with the greatest scholar of his generation, but he was basically, a Kira professional. He went to Chutz Lartz in order to be Makarik people, because he saw there was a tremendous, he was originally from Babel, he saw there was rampant ignorance in Babel, it was terrible, people didn't know that, things like Basar Mechala Barasar. They know the milk and meat and all that eat together. So he went down to live in Babel permanently, and he was going to try to be a Makari people, and he obviously was successful. So David, when he went down from Eretz Yisrael Chutz Lartz, Rebbe would not give him real smicha. He gave him Yore Yore, Yadin Yadin, Yatir Bechoros Yatir, he can paskin on the shilas, he can sit in court cases, he can determine whether an animal which is holy has a blemish or not, but not the real smicha. Which is a major deficit, because you need the real smicha in order to do lots of good stuff, like execute people, impose fines on them, flog them. Without the real smicha, you can't do any of this stuff. So when Rav went down to Babel, the Mar Tereja asked, what could he do? Basically, Mar Tereja, Baba Kama, basically not much. Besides, giving good drushes and making personal takanos, but all they could do really in Chutz Lartz is judge cases of loans and confessions, where somebody confessed he owed money, or theft, but not burglary. Because burglary has a knas, has a fine of twice. And you can't judge fines in Babel, because there's no real smicha in Babel. So there was a very big curtailment of the powers of the rabbinate in Babel. Now, it seems Rebbe didn't want this power to be spread beyond the land of Israel. But there are ways in which, even in Chutz Lartz, you can get such power. There's one major way, which is, anybody know? Right. Legitimate way.
Did you mean to throw a move?
Sorry?
No. If this person descended in Israel and went to the Chutz Lartz, to a different base, then I told them I owe some from...
No, not necessarily. Close. One, that's with two possibilities. First possibility is Dina Machusa Dina. If let's say George Bush has the authority to execute criminals, to, not with his own bare hands, but to order them executed, and he decided to invest that authority in, let's say, Rabbi Shore, right? So then Rabbi Shore could go around killing people, because he has the power which was invested in him by the government, which has that legitimate power and authority. The other way is that sometimes it's based in Makim Oinjin Shalom and Adin, based in punishes and beats people, even though it's not strictly halachic, because as you say, they have people vote, not necessarily they vote into office, but they have actually the status of representatives of the Jewish people of the community. So therefore, they can say in recognition of that, that we now, representing the community, are going to flog this person because he's a threat to the community. Not because the Torah says so, because in order to impose a Torah-mandated punishment, I have to have real smicha. But if I want to impose a punishment on behalf of the community because of something which happened in Smith, so then that might be possible based on the fact that the judges were appointed or voted into office by a majority of the local population. Okay?
Now all this is way after the Mishnah was written down?
Well, no, this is right at the beginning.
You said Babel was uninformed, the people there were uninformed.
Yes, because the sages went to Israel. They went to Israel to study.
And then they returned to
Rome. And then they returned later on.
And they wrote the Talmud there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I thought everybody was there and then they...
No. So, during times of the Mishnayos, anybody who wanted to be a Talmud Chacham moved to Eretz Yisrael and stayed there. Rabbi Chiya moved from Babel to Eretz Yisrael and stayed there. Rav was the first one, really, to make Aliyah and then make Yerida again. To go back to Chutz Lartz in order to spread the word. Okay? The before Rav got there, actually, there are a couple of sages who are mentioned in Gemara. There's one called Karna, whom Rav got into a bitter fight with, and seems Karna did not meet a good end, but we don't have to get into that right now. And Shmuel. Shmuel is also a student of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's. He also didn't get Tzmicha. He was second in significance to Rav. As a matter of fact, in Paskin, like Rav, or in matters of Itza V'Heter, like forbidden foods and things, we pass in like Shmuel in matters which concern court cases, because Shmuel was an expert judge. So Shmuel was already, he preceded Rav, we don't know by how long, not by very long. Karna was there for a long time. Shmuel's father was known in the Gemara only as Abu the Shmuel. Shmuel's father was also a distinguished Rav in Bavel, but really, things started moving into Bavel when Rav came down. He must have had a very powerful personality. His real name was Abba, and he was called Abba Richa, the tall Abba, because he was very tall. I don't know how tall was tall in those days. For a Jew, maybe his father was 7. But in any event, he was called Abba Richa, but out of respect, they called him Rav. Okay? And this is the time when we separate into, actually, the Babylonian Batei Medrash and the Eretz Yisrael Batei Medrash. The Batei Medrash in Bavel eventually will lead to Babel. The Batei Medrash in Eretz Yisrael eventually lead to Talmud Yerushalmi, right? We're going to start with Eretz Yisrael first. So far, so good. Any questions? It's not a lecture. It's supposed to be interactive. No. Okay. Going back to Eretz Yisrael. At this time, around the death of Rebbe, so the major settlement of the Jews was in the Galil. It was kind of like across the Galil, from Tveria all the way across to where Haifa is today. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is buried outside of present Haifa in a place called Beit Sharim. You can go visit his grave today. We know where it is. And people do it's a major tourist attraction. So that entire area was part and parcel of the, was where the Talmud Yerushalmi was formulated. Now, there was a Jewish settlement initially as far south as, Caesarea, but later on, they're even extended as far south as Lod, where Ben Gurion Airport is today. And there was no Jewish settlement at the time in Yerushalayim. So even though the Talmud written in Eretz Yisrael is called Talmud Yerushalmi, nope, it was nothing to do with Yerushalayim. Nobody was living in Yerushalayim at the time.
Why is that?
Because the Romans kicked them out. And I don't know if the decree was still in effect, but they only trickled back over hundreds of years.
So Romans used to live there?
I'm sorry?
Romans used to live there?
Romans, yeah, pagans. Yeah, then Christians.
And Muslims.
First Christians, because the Roman Empire became Christian.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So the Jews were living, the ones who lived in Lod were called Zikne Hadorom, the elders of the south. They appear both in Bavel and Yerushalmi, but there was nobody in Yerushalayim at the time. Now, what's interesting is, there's a difference of opinion between the historians as to the Kesarin, which is mentioned in the Gemara. If you're the Kesarin, it's usually understood to be Caesarea. However, there's a town on the Golan Heights called Katrin. And Katrin has a museum, an ancient village, which is basically dug out from archaeological digs. And they claim that this is the real Kesarin. Not Caesarea on the banks of the Mediterranean, but Katrin in the Golan. And they sustain it because they found one of the broken buildings, had a lintel, a sign over the door. Zeh Beit Medrasho Shel Rabbi Avun. Right? When Rabbi Avun was one of the prominent early Amoraim in the Yerushalmi. You know? So that actually seems to give credence to that view that the Golan was much more of the focus, not Caesarea, the one on the seacoast. Which really makes sense because Caesarea on the seacoast is a very Roman city. Right, it was not very Jewish at all. So it would make a lot of sense that it would be in the north, but nevertheless, it does seem that there were certainly at least some Jews in Caesarea in the south on the Mediterranean. The question is where the primary Caesarean or Caesarean was at the time. So the Jews are in the northern part of Israel, and the primary leader of the Jews at the time, primary spiritual leader, was? No, he was in Bavel. Rabbi? Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was also one of the great students, younger students of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And in fact, there is an opinion in places somewhere, I forget where, that he also can argue Mishnayos. It's interesting because the rationale for that is as follows. It says Rav can argue Mishnayos. But if you have Machlekes, Rabbi Yochanan, and Rav, Halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan. So reason dictates, although it's not an explicit anywhere, that if Rav could argue Mishnayos, Rabbi Yochanan, we passed like over Rav, certainly could argue Mishnayos. But that's not necessarily the case. It could be that Rav had a Mesorah to argue a certain Mishnayos, which variated from the normative Mesorah, whereas Rabbi Yochanan did not. So, it's a big question whether Rabbi Yochanan had the authority to argue Mishnayos. Rabbi Yochanan was the spiritual leader. At that time, in the house of the Nazi, there were a series of short Nasius periods, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, I don't remember exactly the names, but at that time, the Nazi in Eretz Yisrael, his name was Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya. He was the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Okay, so after Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's death, so it kind of quickly went through the next generation, and now to Rabbi Yehuda and the seal. So you had the Nazi and the Sanhedrin, and there was friction. Yeah.
Did he have Simcha?
What?
Did Rabbi Yochanan, right? Simcha?
He had Simcha, yeah. The Amoraim, who stayed in Eretz Yisrael, continued to have Simcha.
So Rabbi Yehuda did not have Simcha, he did.
What?
So if Rabbi Yehuda
Nasi gave Simcha to Rabbi Yochanan and other students.
Rav didn't get.
Okay? So there was friction. Now, this is particularly true between, not so much Rabbi Yochanan himself, but between Reish Lakish and the house of the Nasi. Now, Reish Lakish is one of the most famous Amoraim because he learned in Yeshiva, and then he decided this was not a business for a good Jewish boy, and he became a bandit. Right. And Rabbi Yochanan got him to do tshuva by promising him
his sister
if he did tshuva. And he did tshuva, and he got Rabbi Yochanan's sister to be his wife, and he became one of the greatest sages of all time. He is called Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, sometimes Rabbi Yehuda ben Lakish, but generally speaking, Reish Lakish was a very, very great sage. But we don't paskin like him over Rabbi Yochanan. We always paskin like Rabbi Yochanan over Reish Lakish with rare exceptions. There are a few exceptions in Shas, but not too many. Reish Lakish was a very, very, staunch and, tough kind of guy. And he was not afraid of Rabbi Yochanan. Now, Rabbi Yochanan killed two people in his lifetime just by looking at them. One of them was Rav Kahana, and the other was Reish Lakish. Rav Kahana, according to the Gemara, he was a refugee from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. He was a student of Rav Yehuda, not being confused with Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda, not he was a student of Rav Yehuda in Bavel. By accident, he had killed somebody, and he had to flee to Eretz Yisrael. And he came to sit in Rabbi Yochanan's yeshiva. And Rabbi Yochanan was already a very old man at the time. And it says, this is a very strange thing. First of all, Rabbi Yochanan was a very handsome in his youth. The Gemara in Brachos would say that when Rabbi Yochanan came to visit him, I think it was a Shulman Levi or somebody else who was sick, and it was dark in the house, he just uncovered his arm, and the entire house became illuminated. Because it was such radiant beauty. It says that Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Shulman Levi, whoever it was, began to cry. And Rabbi Yochanan was crying about himself, about his own predicament. But Rabbi Yehoshua Malevi said, no, I'm crying about you. Look at this beauty which you have, that you possess, which eventually is going to crumble into dust. Rabbi Yochanan said, you know what? This is worth crying about. And he joined in the crying as well. It says, Rabbi Yochanan used to sit at the opening of the gate to the mikveh. So women went to the mikveh, and they came up and they were going to have relations with their husbands afterwards, so they should see him first. And they would see him because he was so handsome, and that image would stick in their mind, and they would give birth to more handsome children. They would receive more handsome children. But one catch was, Rabbi Yochanan did not have a beard. And that was regarded as a big flaw.
He didn't?
Didn't have a beard. It's clean shaven.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know if he couldn't grow a beard, or he decided he's more orthodox. I'm not sure which one. But if he did not have a beard. So he's criticized for that. But in any event,
how would he shave down to his skin? I mean, so you're saying he just didn't have a beard because he cut his beard?
No, they used sulfur. But right to this day,
the
depilatories, yeah.
The what?
If people, people don't shave, but are clean shaven, use depilatories. These are powders and ointments which burn away the hair on the face.
Don't burn away the skin?
Sorry, no, it doesn't burn away the skin.
Just the hair.
It irritates the skin, but it doesn't burn away. Yeah, you know, it's produced nowadays for women, of course, and for blacks. Because blacks, since they have curly hair, it's hard to shave. It doesn't work. For some reason, shavers don't work so well on them. So a lot of them...
How does it remove the hair for?
Sorry?
How does it remove the hair for?
It's the same like shaving. It's okay. Not permanent. No,
we're not allowed to
burn your hair
off. Yeah, sure, yeah. There was an Eretz Yisrael, but still to this very day, but certainly in the earlier years before electric shavers came around, the way Yeshiva Bachim used to shave, you know, Lithuania, and Eretz Yisrael, all the Yeshiva Bachim were clean shaven, all the Lithuanian Yeshiva Bachim. Right? None of them had beards. You didn't grow beards until you got married. So what they did is that they used to use this sulfur concoction, this depilatory, and it's supposed to smell really bad of rotten eggs. I've never actually smelled it, but it's supposed to be really, really bad smelling. And they used to lather it on, and a few minutes later they would take a wooden stick and just shave it off. And all of the hair would just fall out.
Imagine a clean-shaven goggle.
What?
You imagine a clean-shaven goggle.
A clean-shaven goggle? Yeah, they don't make them nowadays. No, they don't have. But they were, you know, there always have been a few. The Italian rabbis, the Italian Kabbalists were clean-shaven, and that's why other Kabbalists did not like them. The new Rebbe here in Ar Samach, his name is Rabbi Sperka. You guys know who that is?
Around
the son-in-law of Rabbi Rakowski. Sorry? So his first names are Menachem Azaria, which is a very rare name. He's named for the great Italian Kabbalist, where Menachem Azaria Rabbi Raman Bifano, who wrote several Kabbalistic Sfarim. And I guess that Rabbi Sperka's father, actually no, Rabbi Sperka's father was into and is into Raman Bifano, so he named his son Menachem Azaria, and the Raman Bifano was clean shaven. And therefore, some other Kabbalists would not study his Kabbalah. So then, in 15th century, this is 15th or 16th century Italy, 16th century Italy, and early 17th, rabbis were shaven. They didn't grow beards. They were like the YU type people of their time. They went to universities, they were clean shaven. That's what happened there. If you live in Italy, that's the way things went. Anyway, we digress. Getting back to the topic at hand. So Rav Kahana came and sat in. Rabbi Yechli, he fled Bavel. And we're going to speak a little bit about people left Bavel to Eretz Yisrael next time. But he left Bavel, came to Eretz Yisrael. And he sat in Shir in front of Rabbi Yechli. Rabbi Yechli, when he was very old, it's a very weird thing. I don't understand it. But it says his eyelashes were very long. And his eyes are normally closed. Except he was very weak. So if he wanted to see something, two of his students came with silver forks and picked up his eyelashes so he could see.
That's gonna feel good. That was probably the most obscure thing.
What?
That's one of the weirdest things you could ever say.
Okay.
His forks.
You obviously have to have been there. Is
that a figure of speech?
No.
Why did he cut them?
I don't know. I guess he didn't want to see. Well, a lot of people were not interested in seeing.
It's not sharp.
So it could be that he wasn't interested. He didn't have to. He didn't have to look around him. He would see things he didn't want to see. Why bother? Anyway, so it says he saw Rav Kahana, and Rav Kahana was sitting in front of him, and Rav Kahana, I guess, had a cleft lip. or some other deformity. Rav Kahana was asking a lot of good questions, and he thought when he saw him that Rav Kahana was sneering at, grinning at him, you know, like kind of going, ha ha, I'm smarter than you, right? So he looked at him in a negative way, and Rav Kahana died. So there's a whole elaborate conversation there in the war about where they're going to bring him to bury him. And finally, they brought him into Rabbi Chiya's cave, where Rabbi Chiya was buried, because Rabbi Chiya was also from Bavel. And when they brought him to Rabbi Chiya's cave, so Rabbi Chiya, who was buried together with his sons, who were very, very holy people, Yehuda, and I forget the other son's name, then Rabbi Chiya said to the sons, they're all dead, right? But the Gemara says, Rabbi Chiya said to the sons, let's make way for Kahana so he can come and sit by us. You know, so, like, Tadigim, we saw some Kruim Chaim, so even when they're dead, they're considered alive. So, but ultimately, Rabbi Yochum was persuaded that he made a mistake, and he brought Rav Kahana back to life. So, with Reish Lakish, things didn't go as well. With Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochum Reish Lakish got to a heated argument, and Rabbi Yochum said something nasty to Reish Lakish about, I lifted you out of a banda tree. And Reish Lakish said to him, what good did you do me? There I was called a head, and here I'm called a head too. I could have been the chief bandit. Big deal. I'm now the chief rabbi. Whoop-de-doo. So the Rabbi Yochanan looked at him askance, and Reish Lakish got sick, and he died. So, after Reish Lakish died, Rabbi Yochanan went out of his mind. Rabbi Yochanan, at first, but Reish Lakish's wife, Rabbi Yochanan's sister, came and pled with him not to carry, to let Reish Lakish get better, and he would not hear of it. But after he died, so they brought him one of the other students in the yeshiva, I think Rabbi Shulman Levi, who started, for anything Rabbi Yochanan said, he would bring him 12 proofs that he was correct. That might be wrong on the number. So then Rabbi Yochanan said, what good do you do me? I don't need proofs that I'm right. I know I'm right. When Reish Lakish was alive, he would ask me 24 questions to try to disprove me. And that's how I was able to sharpen my focus on the sugi and understand things much better. And he was very, very depressed that he had killed Reish Lakish. And he eventually went out of his mind. And Chachamim davened for him, and he died. Now, Chachamim davened that he should die. This is a fascinating thing. We see several places, a couple places, also in Rabbi Nasi. Rabbi Nasi was suffering very greatly at the end. I guess the stomach ailment came back.
Why didn't the daven that should get better?
The stomach ailment came back. And, The Rabbanim, all the Tamil Chum were diving, they should continue to survive, and they kept him alive. And he was in agony, so Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's maid, who was a big Tamidah Chachama, she's quoted in a lot of things in Shas. So she thought that this was not good. So she davened that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi should die. She went up to the roof, threw down a pitcher. Everybody was shocked into silence momentarily when the pitcher broke and splintered, and at that moment, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi died. So the Ran in the Dorim says, from here you see, from these Gemaras, that if somebody is really sick, and there's no hope of any normal recovery, you're allowed to daven that they die. You're not allowed to kill them. You're allowed to daven that they die. This bothers you. Oh well.
That's
yeah,
yeah.
So no active killing, just dominating. So Rabbi Yochanan was the primary leader of his generation, as I said, spiritually in Eretz Yisrael, and a lot, as you know, Shas. But Bavli Yerushalmi is full of statements of Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan was, of course, the one who we usually paskin like. Over Rav, over Shmuel, over most of the members of his generation, over Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan was the leading authority in the first generation after, when the dust settled, after Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's death. Okay? So, there was a lot of interaction between Bavli and Eretz Yisrael. And that's why you find Tanoim and Amoroim in Eretz Yisrael, Arli and Amoroim in Chutz Laaretz and vice versa. That's also why you have Tanoim going, Amoroim going up for 7 years to learn in Eretz Yisrael, or going down for 7 years to Bavel, and then coming back afterwards. Also, there's a reason why certain machlokos, certain differences of opinion, are reported both in Bavli and Yerushalmi, but they're reported differently. Because since there was a lot of interaction, but you know, there was also the broken telephone syndrome, right? Particularly since there were no telephones. So everything was broken telephone. Because as things got transmitted from Babel to Eretz Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael back to Babel, so lines got crossed and different, sometimes the shitas are the exact opposite, sometimes they're different than Moroyim mentioned, so there are variances between the Babel and Yerushalmi. There's a common misconception, which goes back to some of the early Rishonim. I shouldn't call it misconception. There's a common held opinion, which is not necessarily true in all cases, that we pass in like Bavli over Yerushalmi. It's not necessarily true. The Rambam, it seems, passed in many times like Yerushalmi over the Bavli. And the question was exactly how accurate he felt each transmission was. So Yerushalmi is of almost equal status to the Bavli. However, it was not learned at all by the Rishonim. Because everything was in the Bavli, and the Bavli, obviously, lasted longer, was assumed that the authors of the Bavli had seen at least part, if not all, of the Yerushalmi. Seems they didn't see all of it, but they saw a great deal of it. So, the Yerushalmi has no Peirushim from Rishonim on it. Only Achronim. Which makes learning Yerushalmi, I'm going to end with this plug, it makes Yerushalmi learning much more fun than learning Bavli. Because in Bavli, you are severely restricted by what Rashi says, by other Rishonim say, and you really can't go back to the Gemara and start changing it around. Yerushalmi, no such restrictions. Yerushalmi, first of all, there are no Rishonim. Secondly, everybody agrees that the text has not been properly emended over time. And when you get a Bavli Gemara, this Gemara has gone through, even though it looks like it's very quite a simple Gemara. This text has gone through many, many, many careful editings over thousands of years. Rishonim edited, Rashi edited, Rav Goyim edited it. First Rabbanus Haburai. We're going to go through all these periods later. First Rabbanus Haburai, then Goyim, then Rishonim, then as late as the Bach or the Gra would be on the side of the page. And so our assumption is that it's going to be very difficult for you to find something which all those people missed. Yerushalmi has no such assumption. So you can go back, particularly if you have access to one of the few manuscripts, but so even not, you can go back and change stuff. It's a lot of fun. And besides that, you figure if Pshat is not in Rashi, not in another Rishonim, or Achronim in a Gemara in Bavli, it's probably wrong, right? It's not that you were Mechad or something, you're an idiot. Because you would find somebody who had said it already, generally speaking, right? But in Yerushalmi, there are no such restrictions. Because since no Rishonim wrote on it, the Achronim wrote on it are not regarded as being final authorities, even though they're very important Achronim, so therefore you can do anything you want to do, Rishonim.
What's going on outside with the other nations at this point, in terms of Jewish peoples?
Everything is Roman Empire. Roman Empire is supreme. There are Jews in, I'll speak about that next time. There's Persia and Rome. Those are the two countries.
And they're pretty much just under the yoke of Rome. Are there ever any conflicts or anything just over?
No, things are pretty smooth. Depending on whether Rome was pagan or Christian, things were bad or good or bad for the Jews. When Rome was pagan, it was good for the Jews. When Rome was Christian, not so good for the Jews.
And they had to pay taxes to the government.
Sure, of course. Yeah, everything went through Rome. Okay, so we'll stop here for this evening.
So the Mishnahs are pretty much the original.